Welcome to the Off the Road Again podcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Ross.
And I'm Dan.
This is our podcast about anything and everything off-road. Tonight, we're going to be a little all over the place, but that's kind of normal. Ross is in the Northeast, I'm in the Midwest, and Dan's out in California. And that's all I got for the open. So yeah, welcome back, Dan.
Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Dan returns.
Ross, what in your list do you want to discuss there?
I have very, very quick and brief things to discuss. So currently there is a Kia that is here. It is a hybrid and it is actually very good. We'll talk about that more after it leaves. EV6 GT next week in California. So that should be fun. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that I'll probably sit in traffic most of the time with it. But you know, that's as Dan can attest, rush hour California commuting life.
But that's good for your range.
Yeah, it was like a perfect use case.
Perfect use of 560-something electric horsepower. Yeah, I had the EV6 sometime last year, and it was excellent. I actually drove it, and by the time I got back to my house, bringing my daughter to the pediatrician, I had more range than when I left, which, thank you, regenerative braking. So the EV6 GT next week, I don't expect that because it is the fast one, allegedly.
You'll never guess who just entered the waiting room.
Huh. Can I guess?
No, you'll know who it is.
Oh, no. Well, it says Mike Levine, so. that's funny. That is exactly how this show goes.
That normally how it goes.
Yeah. But yeah, so.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
I could go through my evening, but that would take us way off course, further off course than these trails. So I am, all I'm going to do is say that I am totally sorry for tuning in here late. It's been one of those days.
You're that completely is fine. We had just actually started to record.
Was Dan able to join or no?
Yeah, I'm here.
Dan's here.
Okay. Amazing. Sorry, guys.
That is very, very okay. On a show of tangents, this is the ultimate tangent. So thank you for joining. Chris, I guess we're just gonna roll through it, right? Just keep going. Yeah, okay. So to round out the local ish press car discussion, after I get back from California, the BMW X7 arrives for a semi-local road trip. And
is that the one with the hideous front end?
I mean, you could just say BMW. And
I know. I literally know nothing about BMWs. I was just making a fun joke.
It's not as bad as the 7 Series, the sedan, or the, you know, i7, but it's not pretty. Although I hear it's extremely comfortable. And then after that, staying on the BMW theme, the Mini Countryman is what I have following that up. So we'll talk about that after. You know, the Countryman theoretically has some rally cred. It's run Dakar, at least in its prior iteration.
You mean the Countryman body has been placed on something else that then ran Dakar?
Yes. Okay. There was a frame on which body that looked like a Mini was placed over much caging. And
Dan's close enough works.
It's marketing. Branding. So yes, that's all I got.
So my update this week is actually a little more enlightening because I actually got an email that says stuff has shipped. So skids and sliders for the Sequoia are on the way. Hopefully in time for the rally in the end of March, early April. You know what shipping's like these days.
Maybe where are maybe they shipping here, from?
Texas.
March, April, and they're shipping
from,
now. I think you'll
from
get them.
Texas. Okay, so from Texas to Kansas City, I think your bigger problem is going to be actually looking at them and the time between you get them, look at them, and install them.
Yeah, that's probably the most. They should be here Saturday.
Parts work.
Right, they should be here Saturday. It should not be that big a deal. But there was one weird thing in the email. It was like one of six, and only one had a delivery date on it, and the other things were like, we'll let you know. So not 100% certain what's going on there. And the only other update I have is I'm seeking a hitch-mounted rear shackle. The Sequoia doesn't have a tow hook on the back of it. And so I'm going to go without replacing the entire rear bumper, since it is my wife's daily driver. We're just going to go with a hitch mount, just throw a big, probably 7/8 shackle on the back of it and go from there. So I don't do a lot in the mud anyway. So,
well, it's going to be in the rocks. Rocks and mud get you in the same issues, just a matter of how sticky it is.
Yeah, there should be enough people sitting around with winches. We'll be okay. Based on the prep that I've seen for the rally, we should be just fine. Yeah. So
Dan and Mike, to fill you in, Chris is, well, actually, we as the podcast have been invited to be the official podcast of the Rogue Overland Rally in Utah, in Moab, the week prior to Easter Jeep Safari. And Chris is going with the 2008 Sequoia, stock height on Toyo AC3s with a little bit of armor. So
a little bit. Rogue Overland is the group that we're participating with.
Oh, I have to look that up.
Yep. They are interestingly, primarily, at least the owner and operator is Nissan based.
They are very much Nissan guys. We were introduced to them through Sean Holman.
Oh, very cool. And where are you guys gonna be in Moab? Do you know yet? You know which trail you're hitting?
7 Mile, and the other one was Devil's Racetrack.
Okay.
So based on the videos I watched for both trails, I think I'll be okay. But there's a reason the armor's coming.
Yeah.
Better safe than sorry.
Very much
so. Along with armor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so I wanted to
I was going to say, never regret when it's needed, you don't regret having it.
100%. And I used to have an 04 Wrangler years ago that those were the only mods I did, was a fuel tank skid plate and a transfer case skid plate and the steering box. That's all I did to it. And then I would beat it everywhere and loved it. It was fantastic, because like, oh, what was that? Doesn't matter. Just a skid plate. Like, we're good. Like, keep moving on.
The blanket statement of all blanket statements is that nobody who has ever gone off road has wished they had less protection.
That's a words to live by right there.
Yeah.
As an off-road podcast, the first thing we recommend is tires. The second thing we recommend is protection, armor, skids, sliders, you know, bumpers. So yeah. Anyways, we'll revisit the Moab trip and Chris's inevitable fender quarter panel damage on his wife's Sequoia.
Don't jinx it. What are you doing?
It'll be fine. I'm sure that they'll get you through everything.
Oh, you forgot to say the Midland radio that I'm going to install in it too.
Yes.
Finally.
About time. Midland was kind enough to send us radios last year after we had them on the show. Thank you to them. And I installed mine shortly thereafter, and Chris is still getting his. So
yeah, it's still there.
Hey, I look forward to hearing about that, because that is one piece of kit that I do not have. And I think that is a great alternative to remembering to bring the walkie-talkies and then making sure that they're charged and then making sure that the batteries are going to hold the charge. Like, those are like three reasons to opt for radios.
Yeah. Mike, the reason you'll like it even more is the receiver, like, Ross, what do you call it? The walkie-talkie portion of it, yeah, with the cord. Everything's in the handset. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not out on a trip, you literally just disconnect it from the radio base, which can be up under the dash or put away, or you can actually have it as like Fords always have those aux switches, or you just put a switch in, mm-hmm, and you just plug in the handset when you're ready to go on a trip.
Yeah, I look forward. I'd love to hear. Please keep us updated on the Midlands, because that, like I said, that's definitely on the Amazon/REI/ 4x4 parts gift list.
The spreadsheet.
Quite extensive on your part, right, Mike?
Well, you notice how I was covering all the bases there, right?
Yes. So. Yes.
Well, we know a guy if you want to get in contact with somebody. Invaluable. Communications comms, like, I mean, there was a time on a...
You can never have too much protection, and you can never have too much comms, okay?
Exactly. There was a time off-roading on the ATVs. Well, correction, I was the only one on an ATV. Everybody else in my group was in a UTV. 10 of us were spread out over 7 miles in Maine. So that plus dust, I mean, comms are invaluable. That, and also the, you know, little flashing strobe lights that you mount to the back of the machines, because you don't want to crash into somebody. Anyways.
Crashing's always bad.
Yeah, crashing is general. Oh, unless you're cool. Yeah, unless if you're, you know, running like one of Cletus's races down in Florida, then crashing's good. Yeah, that is a Forerunner. That picture is taken in.
Yes, I recognize it.
Yeah, that's very cool. Very cool.
It is. It's come a long way since the Cobra CVs of you know.
Right. Yeah, just more range
through the 90s. Yeah.
You do have to get a GMRS license, Mike.
Yep.
Now this has got to be a whole episode. So how difficult is it to get a GMRS license? It seems like it'd be a multi-choice.
You fill out a form and send the form in and pay, what is it, $70?
No, remember, it's cheaper now.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Right. Is this a ham radio then? Are we talking about?
It's not.
No. But you still have to register with the FCC?
Yes.
It's not a FAI. CB. We're talking about something in between ham and CB.
Yes. So GMRS. So the handheld walkie-talkies that almost everybody has all the time are called FRS. And so GMRS is like FRS radios on steroids. So those FRS radios have like maybe a 2-pipe, maybe you get lucky and get a 3-mile range, mm-hmm. where the GMRS never,
right? Especially like hills. Mountain to the horizon with nothing between.
Right. So the GMRS radios actually, you can get range numbers that I've seen 15 miles, Dan, I've seen Dan 20 Aspen. Miles. And there's one that's
these?
Yeah,
those are the little FRS ones.
The one-to-ones? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the GMRS ones take your range out to like 20 miles.
It sounds easier than getting a drone license these days.
100% it is.
Chris has.
Considering I got both. Yeah, it definitely is.
and the unit that Midland sent me allegedly has a 50-mile range. I have yet to test anything further than about 5-ish.
So is it hot rotted from the factory? I mean, a little
no, that's little that's system. A like a production unit.
I haven't touched.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and Mike,
all right, Dan, I think we have something to focus on after this podcast. If I go dark for a couple of moments here, maybe because I'm scrolling through for GMRS receivers.
Again, exactly. We have the contact. So let's dive into it. So first question is, how did you guys meet and how did you decide that you would go on these off-road and camping trips together?
Mike, let's see. I'll tell my version. He can tell his version. I think he was working for pickuptrucks.com and I was at edmunds.com and I don't know if we met at an event or what, but there was a couple of times where we talked about, you know, pooling our resources to do a towing test. I remember that. And, you know, I think we all, Mike, where do you remember? Somewhere, something like that, right?
No, that sounds about right. That back in those days, it was like, oh yeah, let's pool our resources together because we can do a whole lot more combined than we can do alone because of the, You do a test, especially like a tow test or comparison test, and you're talking potentially big dollars to do that.
Yeah, the logistics, especially when trailers are involved, are just insane.
The logistics when trailers are involved for a single person towing a single machine can be insane in of themselves. So yeah, get that. Yeah. But those early pickuptrucks.com comparison tests kind of broke the mold, you know, for the sports car tests. We always had, you know, the measurements, the emotional, and then like the how do you feel about it as a whole. But for trucks prior, there was never anything that really broke it down the way pickuptrucks.com did. And I know personally, at least, I'm fascinated over that stuff. So it's interesting to see the two of you with your collective technical angles come together and you know, find each other in this weird world that we love.
Yeah, I think the trailer towing just kind of blew our mind through the logistics, and it was just like, all right, let's just go camping in the dirt. Okay, that's way easier. dealing with goosenecks and fifth wheels.
Yeah, for sure.
So how do you guys? I mean, for the listeners that may or may not know about this, but Dan and Mike have a tendency to, I guess, find ways to go exploring together and make wherever it is that they are seem unbelievably picturesque and beautiful and, you know, also challenging for the off-roader. So I'm, as somebody who lives and, you know, off-roads in the Northeast and has limited places to do so, how do you guys pick where you're going to go, what you're going to do, like where you're going to camp? That's something from the opposite coast that is really interesting.
I'm just going to dive in, because usually it begins, it may begin with a phone call of me like calling Dan like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and saying, hey man, I think I'm going to get up like really early the next day and I'm going to go camping somewhere. You want to go? And without any regard whatsoever for what Dan's life planning is about.
The family.
And just seeing if I can convince him to join me on a trip somewhere.
Yeah, Mike's the instigator usually. He'll go if I can't. And
he'll go if I can't is a great phrase.
Go by himself if I can't. But I know there was one where he called me and it's like, hey, I got this place I want to go to. It's on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. And he sent me a little thing on Google Maps, a pin where it was. And I looked at it and was like, it's going to be like a 400-mile drive. And he was going to leave the next day. We were going to stay one night. And of course, I'm a nut because I have a little hobby on the side called geocaching. And I love.
Oh, yes.
And there was a geocache like 6 miles from where we wanted to camp. And it hadn't been found ever. And it was like 3 years old. It's like, oh, I'll go. I mean, you know, I would have gone anyway, but that just sealed the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, Mike, you have to let me stop here and pick this thing up on the way. But it was like 50 feet off the trail we were going to use anyway. So it was no big deal.
I have a very close friend who isn't into the off-road world, but he's into hiking and everything. And there's always a side quest to geocache.
There's always a side quest.
Yeah, no, we've done countless hikes together and may or may not have done alleged drag races with his since departed Mini and my since departed Miata. But yeah, geocache, like there's always... It's crazy how you think you're somewhere that nobody's ever been, and then there's a geocache.
Like, yeah,
I think Dan's taken us to a couple of geocaches. Like there was this one by the Grand Canyon. There was another one out by the White Mountains that we had to stop on the side of the road
the New Hampshire White Mountains?
No. Every state has a White Mountains range. If you didn't know that yet.
Yeah, because Springfield.
The White Mountains are parallel to the Sierra Nevada, one range to the east.
Okay.
And so when you're there, you can, from those campgrounds, look at the Sierra Nevada across the Owens Valley. And it's quite picturesque. This was the campground that we went to that's a heck of a video. I don't think I've seen that before.
That's the sunrise video.
Yeah. That campsite was literally on the rim. This is like a side canyon. It's not Grand Canyon proper. We're not quite in the national park. We're in the national forest, so you can do dry camping wherever you want. But it was fantastic. And I had to like set my parking brake really hard in the four rows. So I was going to sleep just in to the be back. Sure. I had the rear open so I could see out the canyon. And it was like, this parking brake better hold.
Right.
You see that? I got a rock, so I supplemented.
Yeah. Every time I see pictures of people camping against Lake Powell, they, you know, they park close enough so that it looks like they're parked against the ledge. And my thought is, I hope the parking brake shoes are good, because I've had vehicles where there was no parking brake shoe.
I was only 10 feet from the lip.
That's the only way. If you're going to go do this without giving away the exact location, you have to find epic spots and definitely make it worth the trip. I mean, you know, I think that's been kind of, you know, whether we've gone to Joshua Tree or whether we've gone to the White Mountains or the Grand Canyon, it's all about, you know, what you're going to find at the end of the trail. You know, it's that, you know, it's one of these things. It's like, you know, you keep trying to find a new, you know, you keep trying to set a new record. And I think in this case, with overlanding and camping, it's like, all right, where's the next trip going to take us? That's going to be like, you know, those epic vistas that, you know, you can really only get to with an overlanding rig, you know, of some type, where you actually, the truck may be sophisticated, but you've definitely earned the destination.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, the term overlanding is, you know, has come into being since I started doing this. And, you know, it was just, I went camping in my Jeep or my 4Runner. But I mean, I kind of like the whole thing. Well, you know, it's a little bit more, I'm going to go and push it a little bit on the road, and I don't know what kind of conditions I'm going to find. So I need a vehicle that has enough capability that if there's a washout or something, because this trail isn't used very often, that I can get to where I want to go and deal with, you know, mm-hmm. It's not like you're driving dirt roads to a mountain bike trailhead. It's right. A little more than that.
It's not state forest roads or something like that.
And there's so much open land west of the Rockies. You just can't believe how much it is. I mean, I remember at Edmonds, we hired a video producer who grew up in New York, and, you know, we took him to an off-road shoot, and he's like, we can do this. We don't have to have permission. We can just go here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very foreign for, you know, Eastern Seaboard type mentality. So yeah, what's the toughest off-roading that you guys have done to get to a campsite?
Mike's probably got a better story there. I mean,
always a good question when there's silence after.
That's a good question. I don't know. I gotta think about that one, because there have been cases. I know, like, the, you know, it's not so much difficulty, like the Grand Canyon one that we were just talking about, is about you're going about 30 miles one way to get to the destination. So you're off road the entire time. And you know, there are definitely areas where mud, depending on the time of the season, is a risk, right? Getting stuck in the mud. I don't know. It's that's it, yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I've got one that doesn't involve Mike. I was in Moab, and at the time I had, you know, that two-door Jeep. And I had driven it there for a Jeep event. And at some point, two of the guys, I think it was a couple of journalists, took one of the Jeeps and went to a place called the Maze District in Canyonlands National Park. Mm-hmm. And the Maze District, Canyonlands National Park, is my favorite. It's huge. It's by, you know, there's the Green River and the Colorado River that come together. And then, you know, two rivers enter, one river leaves, and that's mm-hmm. the Colorado. And each I guess it wouldn't be a quadrant, but each of those three districts is a completely different part of the national park. And the Maze District is the least visited by far. And that was some pretty hairy off-roading to get to where these guys were. Now, the reason I went there is they had said, hey, why don't you come with us? And I'm like, I don't know, I got this BF Goodrich thing I wanted to do. I was trying to butter somebody up for some tires or something. So they went. And then I realized that my hat was in the car they took, because that was the car I'd driven on the press event the day before. So I'm like, well, I'm going to go get my hat. So I did this huge 200-mile thing. If you look at the map from Moab, Hanksville, to the Maze District, it was this huge thing. And then the last 30 miles was like really iffy. The trail was like, you're looking for like black rub marks on the sandstone and cairns. Mm. And it was like, am I in the right place? And yeah, you know, and then I finally got to where they were, and then they were off hiking somewhere, and the wind was blowing, and their tent was like flat.
Oh no.
God.
But it was nuts, and that's a great place I'd love to go back to, the Maze District.
The Maze.
Just incredible.
Canyonlands, that whole area is pretty spectacular.
It's one of those places that you hear about and hear about and hear about, and it just stays on the bucket list, you know?
Yeah, and I want to do the White Rim Jeep Trail, which is this district, which is the island in the sky. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like driving, if you're ever at the Grand Canyon and look down, you see like a kind of a plateau about halfway down. And then it goes to the river after that. That's kind of the White Rim. It's kind of like partway down, but it's really a narrow shelf, a little white rim of a certain type of stone. And you're just driving along that for like 105 miles. It's nuts.
I mean, it's...
Yeah, that's the one you need. The White Rim Trail is, it's about 100 and I think it's about 120 miles long, and you do need permits to camp along the trail. Like that's one that you don't want to do as like a marathon push. It would not be a very fun day. So you definitely want to take at least two nights to do it, and to do so you need to get your permit in through Canyonlands, and you know, the permitting process, they only allow I think a total of 10 vehicles. I think it's 10 vehicles max on the trail per day. It's something super limited, so you know, when you go, it's going to be a special occasion. You've got to get the, you know, you've got to get the campground. I got to look back into it. Every time I look to get the dates, if you don't make the move for the permitting in the first couple of minutes, you're going to be out of luck.
Yeah, I've done like the start of it to a place called Musselman Arch, and then turned around and came back out, you know, and that's like doing a 12th of it, you know, but just to get a feel for it. And it's fantastic. I've never done the whole thing because of the permitting issue and, you know, getting.
Yeah, Dan, maybe we can go this weekend. I'm thinking about leaving.
Yeah, let's.
We're leaving tomorrow morning.
I can throw some stuff in a bag.
I'm thinking about leaving Saturday morning, and maybe we can get back Sunday night.
Man. Yeah, that'd be fine.
What's that crazy trail in Moab that hugs a wall, and there's a huge step, and there's a cliff on the left side as you're going down, and it's
a Jeep trail or a mountain bike trail?
It's Jeep trail. I mean, you can mountain bike it if you want to, I guess.
This portal in Moab is terrifying, but that's more mountain bike.
Oh God. It's
that one doesn't ring a bell, but I have
cliffhanger. Is it cliffhanger?
Well, it sounds like it would be.
as the words come out of my mouth. Yeah.
I'm going to go with that, but no, I haven't done all the trails in Moab. There's just so many. And, you know, I've never been there for the whole week. I've usually just come in for a night or two. And a lot of times, you know, I'll go to Canyonlands while the zoo is going on in Moab, because, you know, there's a video we shot for Car and Driver at Moab last year, where it's Easter Jeep Safari, but we're by ourselves on trails because we just went to Canyonlands, and really only about 8 miles away from Moab, but everybody's down there. So there's so much open space out there. And that's what's great about overlanding. Even though a lot of people seem to be into it, you can still get away from it all and not see anybody out there.
Yeah. I think I think Dan's nailed it. I mean, that's the part that is really the most addicting part of this, is that, you can always find a trail that you've never been on before that's going to take you to a place that's probably quite epic. And even just trying to explore like California, which I personally have been doing for years, I still discover new trails like all the time that I've never been on. And then you think about, you think about how lucky we are to live west of the Mississippi, and that we do have all of this public land space to go off and explore with the BLM. Even if you watch things like the Rebel Rally, like I'm always impressed at Emily Miller and the team at the Rebel Rally, because Emily is constantly searching for new parts of the BLM now into Nevada. That I look at these pictures from the Rebel, and I'm like, oh man, I need to go check that part out.
And that would be the Bureau of Land Management, because
yes,
that's
Yes. Yes.
Yes. Correct.
We haven't had Emily on, but we have become the unofficial podcast of the Rebel Rally.
We literally, based on how it's many mentioned every episode.
And oh, that's based great. On how yeah, many I... guests we've had who have run it or been involved with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You need to get Emily on. Emily, I've known Emily for about 15 years. Mm-hmm. And she is, you know, she is as authentic and a pioneering off-road explorer as there ever was. I'm in absolute awe of what she's done with the Rebel Rally. It's fantastic.
And I feel like it's the right time of year to contact her, since that doesn't happen until the fall. Like, now maybe a little downtime for her, hopefully.
Well, she's doing the training now for the next class that's going to do the Rebel. So definitely a good time to get hold of Emily. You guys should definitely have her on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. We would love to. Emily, if you're listening, no time like now. So, Mike, when you are facing a weekend in which you are, or a weekday, whenever it is that you think you have the prospect of going away with a trip that involves Dan or doesn't involve Dan, how do you decide what vehicle you're going to take? I mean, we know we have your own Ranger, but I mean, we've seen, you know, pictures you've posted of countless vehicles from the Ford fleet. How do you pick and choose?
I mean, it totally depends. You know, if it's something new take Bronco Raptor, for example, obviously I'm completely in awe of Bronco Raptor. You know, just, I'll grab hopefully one of my kids. If Dan's not available, I usually deputize one of my kids to come with me.
And hold the camera. You don't have a choice.
And, yeah, exactly. And we'll take them camping, and really just to get a sense for me to take a vehicle and disappear off into the mountains for a day or 2 days or 3 days gets me much better acquainted with the vehicle than even just like a 1 day driving program. Just so I can, you know, if I'm going to talk to other, you know, journalists about it, I don't want to be talking about it just off a spec sheet. I want to be talking about it because I've actually taken the vehicle and pushed it to see what it can do and what the, you know, what the pros and cons are with the vehicle, just so I can kind of rank it in my head of where it sits. Like, I'll give you one quick example, like Bronco Raptor, absolutely fantastic for going just about anywhere. Like, it is an unstoppable beast of a vehicle. Would I take it camping for more than an overnight trip? I'd have to think about that a bit more, because what I can do with my Ranger is with the cargo box is I can fit a whole bunch more gear in the back, and I can still take three or four people with me. Mm-hmm. And I don't get quite that space luxury conveniently in a Bronco Raptor. So there's definitely pick your vehicle well, depending on what trip you're about to go off and do.
Mike, what tent do you use?
Well, I've got a ground tent. It's you got it right there. It's the Shift Pod.
Shift Pod. Because
I always get asked about it. Usually, people just think of it as space camping.
That's what it looks like.
It really does. Yeah, it looks like you've transported Mars onto your onto the ground behind the Ranger in this picture.
Yeah, it's a really cool company. They're out in Northern California. You may have seen them at like, I know they're pretty popular, Burning Man. Anyway, the advantage of it is, it sets up in about 2 minutes. You throw down a floor in the tent and you're ready to go. You don't have to worry about all the poles and all that stuff. It's just
sold.
To me, the most valuable thing is how quickly can I set up a tent and then start to enjoy the weekend versus me wrestling with a tent, trying to get it set up.
That's why rooftop tents exist.
Absolutely true. And there's pros and cons with rooftop tents.
More cons than pros, but we love them. We do love them. You know, there's a counterculture for people going back to ground tents and in the pop-up tents these days, and it's very interesting to see as the media and the overlanding fame comes with the rooftop.
Yeah, it's definitely a pendulum. And I'll say this because Dan is camped inside of his 4Runner before. I'm like, oh man, then I don't have to keep opening up this tent and popping it back up, and I don't have to worry about a rooftop tent. I can just kind of, you know, sleep in the back of the truck, which is a whole thing unto itself for some benefits.
Ross was trying to convince me recently to buy a fairly cheap Chevy Avalanche with a bed cover with the midgate that folds down and use that to sleep through.
Remember that Avalanche we were talking about before, Dan? This is the same Avalanche.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, yeah, for me in the 4Runner, you know, it's got kind of a weird folding seat where you know, you fold this one up and then this one down. Mm-hmm. And what I do is before I go home is I take this bottom piece out because it's just two bolts. Mm-hmm. Then when I fold this down, this thing isn't there. And so it makes it like 6 inches longer, and I'm 6'2". And so I just stack all my belongings behind the 40% seat. And then mm-hmm. I sleep on the 60% side.
Oh yeah.
And I did that on the, in a JL, UR, on the Mojave Road, and the same sort of thing. But I am kind of looking pretty hard at a rooftop tent, specifically the Go Fast Camper, the GFC, because I really like the way that kind of replaces the roof rack and kind of becomes its own roof rack that you can bolt stuff to. It's pretty low profile and really well made, but you know, it's also
GFC makes very, very nice equipment, as does like iCamper and whatnot. I'm curious why though, have you considered, so the 4Runner is like a 60-40, like a two seats and a single seat split. Have you considered like a platform, like a sleeping platform kind of deal where you...
Yeah, I don't want to remove my seats, you know, and I know that, what's the big company that's right in Costa Mesa that does all the platforms?
I was going to say Goose Gear, but I don't know.
Goose Gear's the big one, yeah.
Yeah, no, they make some great platforms, but you got to do seat deletes. And, you know, I still want to have a four-seat 4Runner. So by just pulling out that bottom cushion on the 60% side with two bolts just before I leave, I can kind of create a sleeping platform. The only problem is the 4Runner kind of does a little one-inch step near the back, you know, where they have their pull-out slide option, which I don't have.
Yep.
And I would probably I would probably put a piece of marine plywood in there to make it level and then end up with the same thing.
But you know,
I'll tell you who has a really great setup, and I think it's probably the best setup that I've seen yet, is Micah Weber, who is Overland Under Budget on Instagram. And Micah has a older Tacoma, and he took the cargo box off, and Micah completely fabricated like a camper shell for the back of his Tacoma. So it's become like this enclosed sleeping platform back there. And it has like, and now he's integrated a pop-up roof to it, but you don't need to pop up the roof to sleep in it. It's the shell itself is both the storage and the cargo box. And there's a picture of it right there. And I think like you can see with the sides up, I think the work that Micah has done on that is absolutely fantastic. And you can see he's even really integrated. Yeah. He's got Pelican That's boxes beautiful. That he fits underneath the custom. He's done this all by himself. And that is truly an epic overlanding rig.
FJ Steele is too. Very, very nice.
That's a nice looking rig.
Very good. Yeah. I would just do like a single twin, like single person inflatable mattress in the back of the truck and call it, you know, like this setup that we're seeing on screen is incredible for somebody who spends significant time in their vehicle, you know?
Yep.
Like that's not daily driver unless it's just, you know, around town, and presumably he's just commuting around Seattle based on the way that looks.
Yeah. I mean, I've done a lot of backpacking and, you know, ground tents and that, but, you know, especially out here in the desert, the ground could be pretty rocky. and you can spend a lot of time clearing a spot. Maybe you are in a place where you probably shouldn't clear a spot. You can just kind of park wherever you want if you sleep in your vehicle or if you have a rooftop tent. Mm-hmm. But you know, everybody has their own preference. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That is absolutely right. We could spend a whole episode. I could spend a whole episode just trying to debate the merits of blow up mattresses versus faux mattresses. and what's the better way to do it? Cause I'll tell you what, one other thing I've just come across with the blow up pads is they're amazing for insulation. But I just got a USB powered little pump to blow up the air mattress. And I got to tell you, that thing is, that's like a life changer. Like, oh wait, I don't need to breathe into this thing to pump it up and hand pump it. I can just take this little tiny USB thing that, and it's just these little tips and tricks as you start to go camping, whether it's ground or rooftop or whatever, the things that make the difference between really enjoying the time out there or worrying about how much time you got to spend setting this stuff up.
Well, there was the trip back to that Grand Canyon overlook that I couldn't go on where you guys saw the condor. And it it was like really super cold. And you were telling me something about you got like a cubicle heater and you had rigged up something to have heat in your tent.
Oh, so that's another game changer. Yeah. So quickly, I've gone to solar. I started with solar for a Dometic refrigerator. Cause mm-hmm. once you go with a Dometic and you don't have to fill a cooler with ice, you don't worry about your food floating on water, you know, 24 hours later. So the first thing that led to a better sleeping experience was getting a refrigerator and then using the solar panels and then discovering batteries, just how great the batteries have gotten with solar recharging. And then finally getting a large enough battery to run like a 100 watt, 150 watt, you know, kind of desk heater all night in the tent. And it was the difference between outside, I think it was about 20 degrees. And inside the tent with the heater running all night with the battery off the solar, it was probably about 60 degrees inside the tent. Like,
oh, wow.
That's amazing.
Total game changer.
60 degrees. Oh, my God.
That's hot.
That's luxury. That's crazy.
Oh, that is luxury. Yeah, absolutely. Especially for winter camping.
Seriously. Yeah. I mean, the akin to that, the technologies that we're seeing, like yesterday, I finally got one of those brick USB plug-in jump starters. It's like a, you know, a...
Yeah, just in case.
8x4 thing that has jump cables that you plug into it, and it's like I never could have imagined something like that, you know, in the same way that you're camping in 60 degree heat when it's 20 degrees outside. Like, the advancements are crazy, and the solar too. Like, could you have imagined a Dometic fridge keeping your food cool? No, you know, it's really it's game changing. It makes you think about the way you off-road and the way you overland completely differently. Have you guys, and this is something that has come up recently, I'm curious if either of you think it's for the worse, because part of the joy of off-roading is isolating yourself from your normal daily life and eliminating those things that make daily life comfortable and normal and connected. So, I mean, this might be an asinine question, but do either of you find any like over normalcy in the luxuries that come from modern technology?
Dan, you want to go?
Well, the answer could just be no. You could just say
no. I'm there to see, you know, the cool landscapes and the geology and, you know, get away from it all. And having a little bit of heat doesn't really change that. I don't want to, it's not me trying to punish myself. I just want to see some cool stuff and kind of get away from it all. But heat isn't it all that I'm trying to get away from. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not going to like play my boombox tunes because that kind of crosses that line. But I'll use
those people kind
of thing to start a match, and I'll have lights, you know, if I need them. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's not about, you know, rolling back the clock 100 years.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that I think Dan's spot on. It's not like we're trying to be in Conestoga wagons, you know,
trying to be pioneers.
Range here. Yeah, this isn't the Oregon Trail. Yeah, no.
I think Dan nailed it. I mean, the point is to, you know, because the same could be said about all the great capabilities that come with today's vehicles. Like, you know, I've got a weekend free. Hopefully Dan will have a weekend free so I can bug him to go camping with me. And, you know, it's the way to kind of recharge after, you know, working a work week, whether it's working from home during the freaking pandemic where we were just looking at the same walls every day, or going through, you know, a really intense work period. You just want to, you want to get outdoors and just kind of rejuvenate. And that doesn't mean that you need to deprive yourself of at least having like a halfway decent meal of some, you know, you know, take a couple of burgers. You know, certainly you can cook them over the campfire, or, you know, you'd whip out the propane stove and, you know, cook them a little bit faster and stuff like that. It's, you know, it's the whole experience without, like, I can't imagine I'd ever, well, let me just be clear. I would never bring a television set with me. Like, that would defeat the whole nature. Like,
yeah, right.
I might as well just be sitting at home watching an Apple TV wallpaper go by. Right.
Yeah. I'm not going out there to watch Ted Lasso or anything, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You're although not going we absolutely will all watch Ted Lasso.
Well, yeah. Of course. Yeah. just not when there's a choice between Ted Lasso or a California condor.
You got condor pictures there?
Right.
If he's got condor pictures, I'm pretty far down. I haven't found them yet.
Okay. I don't remember what month that was on Mike's feed.
I don't know. They'd probably be a little bit, maybe a little bit closer to the top. But that's like seeing, but see, that's the type of thing that makes really getting out into the middle of nowhere like so worth the trip to get out there, because first of all, you don't know what you're going to run into, whether it's bighorn sheep or a California condor. And the California condor pretty much borders on like a religious experience, because the thing is, you know, it's like watching a dinosaur. It's got like the wingspan must have been 8 feet. And it's looking at you as intently as you're watching it, and you realize, I may not be quite as near to the top of the food chain as I might think I am out here in the middle of nowhere.
He's trying to size up your health and see if he can help you along.
And then take into account, you know, that pterodactyls or pterodon had a wingspan of like 40 to 44 feet.
Right. Yeah. The condor, the coolest part about the condor, besides the size and the rarity of it, was you could hear it moving the air with its wings. Like you could,
oh wow,
you could literally hear the air moving around it as it circled us a couple of times, to Dan's point, to check out our health and see if it was going to have a meal in a couple hours.
That's crazy.
I ran into a couple juveniles the last time I was at the Grand Canyon.
Wow.
But they were just, they were like literally just right on the rocks there, right by the South Village. And the amount of people that were like over fences that were too close, I'm like, what are you nuts doing? Calm down, get out of the way. Let them just live.
It's another reason to get out there and find the trails to go off and explore. And, you know, get to the spots that are, you know, the rare spots, but, you know, still have some of the conveniences to make sure you're going to enjoy the trip.
Yeah. Wildlife is definitely a factor that people who see the off-roading and overlanding culture from the outside don't expect. Like in the Northeast, we have moose and wolf, you know, it's like they're very present when you least expect it. So. Yeah, it's a special thing that
I thought you were going to pivot wildlife into hammers.
Well, that's a different kind of wildlife.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I thought he was going.
That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, that is a pickup, and thank you for teeing that up and taking the line. Let's talk hammers. So So Mike, we've had Vaughn on the show and
Lauren.
Yeah, we know Hammers went well. So can you tell us about your experience and what Hammers means to Ford?
Yeah, absolutely. I think King of the Hammers is one of the, if not the coolest off-road event with many, many people that there is right now. I just think it's such an impressive spectacle to mm-hmm. see. And a reason for that is, one is it combines the best of go fast desert racing, but it also throws in there extreme rock crawling. Mm-hmm. And so you see these custom made rigs that, you know, people may have fabricated in their garage that look like moon buggies are competing in King of the Hammer. So it has a very much a grassroots feel to it. For Ford, we've gotten involved from the Bronco side just because a couple of years ago, even before Bronco went on sale, Bronco was developed in Johnson Valley, which is home of King of the Hammers. Mm-hmm. So on many of the same dune and rock courses, the whooped out portions of Johnson Valley, like that's where our team has actually gone out and developed Bronco. So Bronco has kind of a natural fit in Johnson Valley. And it's very much like, it's gotten to the point where when you look at Bronco Raptor, we made a specific point with Bronco Raptor that it is the world's first Ultra 4 inspired SUV, and Ultra 4 racing is what happens in King of the Hammers and other events within the Ultra 4 racing mm-hmm. series. So it's this notion of combining the best of going fast and that extreme rock crawling into one. But what makes King of the Hammers go that extra mile, I think that's so cool, is at night after the racing is done, it's on Bureau of Land Management public land, and the race course closes, and then it becomes public land again, essentially. So you will see the spectators immediately flock onto some of the most challenging parts of the courses with their home-built rigs and try to run up those same challenges. It would be like going to the Daytona 500, and after NASCAR is done for the day, they just say to the spectators, okay, track's yours. Whoever wants to go out and race at the the track, go for it. I mean, it's that type of,
for better or worse, it is the ultimate hold my beer and watch this.
That's exactly. It's so much fun and so challenging and so grassroots, and it all comes together.
So the crossover between racing and production vehicles isn't new to Ford. I mean, you guys have done F-150 and Baja. You know, there's been like Raptor Baja crossovers, and then now there's the Bronco crossover. Is there a clear defined way that this makes it from what you learn and see in the off-road racing community to production vehicles, the way that everybody speculates and theorizes that F1 cars have trickle down stuff to like street cars? You know, is this R&D?
Yeah. So the short answer is yes. And this goes all the way back to like Henry Ford and the sweepstakes race car that he had to raise money to start Ford Motor Company. Like motorsports has been that much of at Ford's mission. But you can, what you see is just like Rod Hall won the Baja 1000 back in 1969 and was the only racer to ever, he and Larry Minor were the only racers to ever win with a stock 4x4, the overall Baja 1000. Today, what you'll see is we're actually taking, we've got this Bronco DR, the Desert Racer truck. Yeah. And that, what makes that so compelling is it is a not street legal turnkey truck that's meant to go race the Baja 1000. But the parts that are in it are a 10-speed transmission from the F-150, the 5-liter Coyote V8 from both Mustang and F-150. The frame is a stock frame from the Michigan assembly line for Bronco. So it's almost like I you would say it was trickle down from racing to stock vehicles. I would tell you it goes both ways, because now you're seeing this turnkey desert racer that's using all these stock parts that we know have been proven in F-150 and Bronco out in places like Johnson Valley. And then you see some of these learnings come back to make a vehicle or inspire a vehicle like a Bronco Raptor that's a much more affordable version of a Bronco DR that is street legal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. And some of our past guests have driven it recently. I think
Emmy just had it. Yeah.
Yeah. Next question. If Dan walked up to you and full on Matrix style said red pill or blue pill, would you rather take that Bronco, the DR, into Baja together or do hammers together? Which would you pick? And Dan can also answer this.
Oh man, I think I have to go. This is too difficult of a question.
Well, this is something that you could possibly employ and make a reality should you want.
Man, hammers is so tempting. But I have to say, I've pre-run the 500 with Ivan Stewart, and that was incredible. I think the long form high speed. I mean, I love rock crawling, but I think the long form, like into the night, wake up again and still going on, you know, with co-drivers and all that. I love the teamwork aspect of that.
Hammer seems so technical.
Yeah.
That's a toughie.
I know. We've had a bunch of people in the Baja community that have come on the show. I mean, Kurt Williams from Cruiser Outfitters and the Land Cruiser Museum, you know, Kangaroo Racing has run Baja. And we had Larry Chen on talking about Baja. And we have Lauren talking about, you know, hammers, and we've had countless people talking about hammers and
Levi
and Levi. And it's just, it's such a testament to how far the interest in four-wheel drive has come over the last 20 years. You know, when I think back to my childhood, it was rally racing or it was Baja. There was like no, you know, in between. And it's really exciting to see how far things have come. I mean, Dan was just on a freaking 911 off-road launch, you know, like how is this a thing, you know? And meanwhile, we have Broncos with like 500 horsepower that you can buy off the dealer lot and, you know, allegedly jump. And then something else I did want to talk about that Mike and Dan both might be interested in is a 700 horsepower freaking F-150 with, you know, with Fox shocks. So it's wild. Can we talk about Raptor R, please?
Up to you guys.
I've spent time with the TRX and we've talked about this to an endless extent, but Raptor R seems to be even better. Where does it go from here? Like, that's one of the problems with cars and trucks over the last 10 years is like, we keep hitting this new level of like, of truck, big car, you know?
I think you've just discovered the third leg of what we were just talking about earlier, which would be you can never have too much shielding on your truck. You can never have too much communications. And the third one would probably be you can never have too much suspension travel.
Yeah, I'd go suspension travel because I like the Raptor non-R version just fine, but man, you add the horsepower, it's just insane. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you combine the horsepower with the chassis, and it's a pretty magical combination. Especially over whoops, you know, around Borrego, like where that truck was developed. That just goes to show you just how far today's rigs have evolved to take on just about any type of terrain. You just gotta, you know, you pick your rig for what you want to go off and do.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Just and to your point, Ross, you know, the suspension tuning of the TRX just doesn't quite do it for me the way the Raptor setup does. Feels so much more balanced. And I think it's probably a better daily on the road too. I think some of the things that the TRX does don't necessarily translate into a good daily. That's why I think the Raptor is my favorite there. And I still remember the Dawn Patrol launch thing where we left Pahrump, Nevada before the sun rose to drive to Juneau and just tear ass around there. And those were some great courses they had set up.
And that was one. Dan joined on a special Raptor media drive where if I was going to do it, I told everyone ahead of time because it was summertime, but that was the best time to do it, that we were all leaving the hotel at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think any media before they came with us, it was like, if you join us, we are leaving the hotel at 3 o'clock in the morning to beat the heat to get the trucks out to the dunes. But the suspension and the power combination, there's really hard to beat.
Yeah, and I was going back and forth. Do I want the 35s? Do I want the optional 37s? Because, you know, that's a choice when you don't get an R. And, you know, there were certain obstacles where I liked the 35s better and other things where the 37s were better. But, you know, I mean, there's more articulation on the 35s just because they let the wheels travel a little bit more. But it doesn't add up to a whole lot on the ramp, not as much as I thought.
It is crazy that 37s are an option. I remember the TJ Jeep Rubicon had 33s, and that was like in 2004, that was unheard of, you know?
Right.
And then the Power Wagon came out and you could fit 35s without a lift. And now, you know, now it's 37s and between Raptor and Bronco, like it's almost the horsepower wars in a weird off-roady way. It's like, who's gonna be the first 40s? And fuck, what is that? Like, what is the connotation that comes with
it? Well, at some point you get a lot of rotating mass and it becomes, you know, difficult to deal with. because
seriously,
this 37 that you're seeing here on my it weighs 108 pounds.
The tire does.
And that's without the optional beadlock rim. That's with the beadlock trim ring that you have to take off when you buy the Ford Performance beadlock ring to go on. But yeah, that's 108.5 pounds right there. And you know, if you went up to 40s, what would that be? But
we know what it is. I mean, it's not just the additional, you know, unsprung mass. It's also the wear and tear that it takes on, you know, brakes and CVs and diffs and everything that travels between them. Like, it's 130-ish pounds.
You know? By the way, you know, that... Those that ramp test is something I feature on my YouTube channel. And because I took a full-time gig with Car and Driver just over a year ago, my YouTube channel production's been a little bit light, but I have shipped some footage to Car and Driver's video edit team. And actually there is a Raptor R suspension deep dive and ramp test that is in final edit that might show up.
Ooh, I need to
maybe by the time this airs, it'll already be up.
Nerds like us need more of that content.
And this is like I said, this is what makes, I think, suspension the new horsepower for off-road vehicles, because it really is the combination of, you know, wheel and tire choice, suspension technology. Are you talking, you know, is it internal bypass? Is it spool driven suspension? You know, there's just, there's such a new frontier of technology that's being applied to off-road. And it really does come down to trying to figure out what are you going to do most with the vehicle that you're about to purchase, to make sure that, you know, you're buying the right, you know, right tool for the right trail, to have the, you know, best experience.
Right. Well, and you know, I think I said it earlier, I love the Raptor that doesn't have 700 horsepower. And the difference between the Raptor R and the regular Raptor is 300 horsepower or so. But I mean, suspension is what, you know, I mean, I can get into a lot of trouble with a base Raptor, and or avoid a lot of trouble with a base Raptor, because the suspension, I mean, that's, well, of course I'm biased because I have a suspension background and development, and, you know, engines are great and horsepower is awesome, but suspension is what's going to help you put it down to the ground and, you know, make time.
Power torque mean nothing if you can't actually do anything with it.
Right.
Yep. That's totally true. I think where the 700 horsepower really pays off, in particular for Raptor, is in sand. And the fact that, I mean, you could just go into so many different scenarios of like dunes and know that, you know, airing down and having all that power, that you're going to claw your way out, and you're going to float over just about any type of scenario. And you're going to be able to climb really steep dunes. And that's where that horsepower really comes to pay off, is in that particular, you know, sand dune scenario.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting, because I had a very similar experience, you know, with that 911 Dakar in Morocco. We went to a big sand dune formation called Er Gchebi, which is basically like Glamis. Picture Glamis and you're there. And
Glamis in Morocco.
Well, I mean, you know, we flew to Arachidia and drove to Er Gchebi, but that's like flying to Yuma, Arizona, and driving to Glamis. And,
amazing.
That's what we did. But I mean, here's a vehicle that's built on the GTS. So it's got a whole ton of horsepower and an all-wheel drive system, but it weighs 3,400 pounds. So, I mean, it doesn't have 700 horsepower, but it also doesn't weigh as much. So, I mean, the power to weight ratio might be kind of similar, but that thing was much more of a dune buggy than I don't know what I expected when I went to go drive that thing, but it was just a laugh riot in the sand. And, you know, we're just laughing out loud in the car saying, I can't believe I'm doing this in a 911. I mean, that was pretty much, you know, on repeat in the car. It was nuts.
Well, you guys have heard the trope about, you know, around a given track, the Corvette will out accelerate anything from corner to corner, and then the Miata will catch it and keep up in the turns and rinse
it. I've lived that.
Yeah. Of anybody, you've lived it. But it's the utter application of it. It's not what you do with the power, it's how you use it. You know, and it's what kind of fun you have with it too. I mean, we're seeing, you know, the trickle down from the huge horsepower wars and huge suspension wars, from F-150 Raptor to, you know, Ranger Raptor now and Bronco Raptor, in the same way that it's happening across all of the other companies. And it's setting a new standard, which is becoming of increasing concern on the writing a check front, but also
checks.
You know, also that it's becoming of increasing concern for the people who make checks.
you mentioned Ranger Raptor, and I think I'm really looking forward to that, because I know Mike probably remembers this trail on the White Mountains that we went to, where when we left, it was pretty much, I wouldn't say it was the worst desert stripe I've ever seen, but it was pretty good. And I'm thinking taking a Raptor through here would just be, you know, difficult, but a Ranger Raptor, you know, might be just right sized enough to get through that trail. I don't know if you remember that one, Mike, but.
Oh, no, no. When we were talking earlier about the, what was the most difficult trail that we've been on, mm-hmm. what immediately flashed back was when we went the other direction and we went through that sagebrush for like miles.
Yeah. And I had, my 4Runner was still pretty new and didn't have any scratches on it yet. I was like,
yeah, we classify trails in the Northeast by full width or midsize. So
yeah.
Get it.
Well, this was definitely not Raptor friendly, this trailer, or TRX friendly, or, you know, or full size truck trend.
Turning radius friendly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That said, I do want to touch at least quickly on electrification and EVs as they come into the off-road 4x4 truck SUV pickup world. I know, Dan, you just spent time with the R1T, or at least sometime in the last, since we spoke last, spent time with the R1T. Yeah. I spent a week with the F-150 Lightning last fall and put about 1,000 pounds worth of Polaris in the back. I'm curious, as we move towards the general public accepting and understanding what EVs mean for normal vehicular use, how you guys think about this in terms of off-roading and overlanding, because the two of you have a special use case that does fall into a niche, but also does forebode what normal people will seek in their vehicles. So I'm just curious how you think about it and what you expect coming forward.
Well, I mean, I've, like you said, I've done some R1T off-roading. I also took a Jaguar I-Pace up a mountain road near here, Saddleback, you know. Jeff Glucker knows it very well.
Yes, and, he does.
Yes.
And it was like a 22-inch wheels with 30 series tires, so the tires and wheels were, it was total wheel peril. Yeah, there it is. And
wait, that's the normal thing that Glucker does his videos on?
Well, it, yeah, there's more difficult stuff too, but I mean, it's really close to his house. I mean, but the point is,
hi Jeff,
I loved the idea of off-roading. I just was completely taken by the experience. You mentioned the critters and all of that. So driving up this trail, I'm hearing water in creeks I never heard before. I'm hearing like birds while I'm driving by with the windows down, because, you know, in my JK, I'm in low range. The fan, you know how Jeep fans are, is just all you hear. It sound, you feel like this thing's got a propeller that's pulling you up the hill. I mean, that's how much noise it's making. But in the Jaguar and the Rivian, it's like you're actually hearing water and wind and animals, and you're not scaring stuff away as you approach. A problem was hikers coming down the hill or cars coming the other way can't hear you, but that's, you know, that's usually the case anyway, because they have their own motor noise drowning out the environment. Yeah,
and music,
but,
and conversations and whatnot.
I love the idea of it. And then there's the torque. And the fact that it's dual motor, all-wheel drive, and you just go, and you don't have to, you know, I don't want to say you don't have to put it in low range, but I mean, there's so much low-end torque, and it's just one gear. It's just utterly smooth. And then all the way down the mountain, I'm regenerating, and I'm just using, you know, the one pedal driving coming down. You can just like creep through creeks and out the other side. It's the actual driving part is pretty outstanding. Now, you know, I have my qualms with the Rivian and the way the suspension works. I think that McLaren drive system is a little too clever for its own good. And I'm not sure if I like four motors. I think I'd rather have two, because there's always this thinking going on between the left and right side. And it seems like, you know, it's not just doing what I want it to do. It's interpreting what I want to do. And then calculating a result, and it's not always getting it right.
It has more brains than it has.
Yeah, but yeah. The, you know, it's going to come down to range And I think range is an issue we solve along the way. Because, you know, if you can charge and you have 300 miles of range, you could do the White Rim Jeep Trail in an EV. If you could fill it up in Moab, mm-hmm. You know, you might not be able to do some of the stuff we've done, but I mean, even like going to the North Rim, if we could fill up in St. George, Utah, before we get to the last leg, you could do it, mm-hmm. you know.
And if you have,
it's going to take more fast charging stations and more, you know, more rural or national park adjacent areas. But I think we'll get there. So I don't know, Mike, what do you think?
I heard chargers and Kanab is what I just heard. Yeah. We need chargers and Kanab.
And I think there are like a limited number of chargers in Kanab. Like there's like four or five chargers in Kanab and that's it. And I certainly charging infrastructure is part of it. I would look at this right now. And I think to the same question that was being asked earlier, which is like, where do you go from a suspension that you have today and the horsepower that you have today? I would look at this and I'd look at the new architecture and form factors that EVs can provide without having to, you know, put an internal combustion engine in the front. And I think that in 20 years, we're going to look at, you know, the way we would look at Bronco Raptor today or a Porsche Dakar today and be like, how did they just figure that out? Like, how is that vehicle doing that? I think we'll look back and we'll be like, oh man, that was like looking at a 4x4 from 20 years ago and seeing how far we've come. I think we're going to see totally new suspension setups, totally new drivetrains that are more connected to what you want to do with the vehicle off-road. I think electrification is going to open up a whole new side to off-road and off-road capability that isn't possible today with purely internal combustion or hybrid powertrains. And then the other thing to kind of bring it back to where we started the conversation in terms of camping is, you know, like, you know, I could take either a Lightning or an F-150 Power Boost and go camping with it. And I don't need solar necessarily because I can draw off of that giant battery pack with the generator, and I can, you know, power, lighting, heat,
yeah.
You know, all electric sorts stove. Of different things. Mm-hmm. You know, when you've got 7.2 or 9.6 kilowatts of power at your disposal for a campsite, it's like you're not just powering your campsite, you're powering all your friends too. So
right.
Figure out, trying to extrapolate where we're going to be like 10 years from now or 20 years from now. I just think we're going to look back and we're going to be like, I can't believe we thought those vehicles were so advanced, because what we have 20 years from now is going to make it look like space age, something or other.
And yeah. The really, really exciting thing from the outside of the industry looking in is the increase and proliferation of power density. You know, the same way that we're packing more range and more power into a given vehicle, you know, like a Lightning in 5 or 10 years is going to be incredible. You know, it'll be lighter and it'll be more versatile. Solid
state batteries will come online at some point, and the charging time aspect will kind of cease to be as big of an issue as it is in people's minds right now.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's only, I mean, we're just at the start of this, really.
Yes,
exactly.
Are. Yeah.
And the actual driving part, the actual off-roading part is great. And, you know, it's really just going to be charging and range and being able to charge just to allow you the freedom to go where you want. And that'll develop because there's getting to be a critical mass of vehicles that need it. And it'll happen. And it's just great. I mean, I really enjoyed just the quiet. You felt like the quiet that you're seeking when you get to the destination, I was also able to enjoy on the way there.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's super compelling. I think, Dan, I think you nailed it. Like the fact that you can roll down the window and you'll hear the crunching of gravel.
Yes.
And when the minute you stop, all you hear is
the wind,
whatever that ambient noise is in the outdoors.
So
it's really cool.
After 5 or 10 years of silent daily driving and silent off-roading, do you guys think that you will still find excitement and peace and joy in sports cars and vehicles with loud V8s and open exhausts? Yes. And manual transmissions?
Of course.
Good. Thank you. I'm glad that's the answer.
I was going to say it's pretty hard to beat the intoxicating sound of an F-150 Raptor R.
Yeah. And I mean, I've been to I do a little course marshaling at road races, you know, the Long Beach Grand Prix and things like that. And there was a Formula E race that I flagged, and like right at the track, you know, communicating with the drivers with flags. And there's like, you know, F1, sons of F1 drivers, retired F1 drivers. Mm-hmm. They're fighting hammer and tong. And I was bored. And yeah. and there was a mom with her baby kind of behind me, and I could hear the baby crying and fussing over the cars as they were racing up. And it's like the visceral component of that is just really important. And that really drove that point home. I mean, it, you know, obviously there's excitement in any kind of racing, especially when you're watching it on TV, but the live experience just kind of wasn't there for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's probably
as a spectator, as a driver, I'm sure it's great
for the visual onlooker side of things that will eventually come from away from the scene spectating, the way that people have blocked to Drive to Survive and, you know, are watching F1 versus buying tickets, even though we're seeing, you know, record highest ticket attendance sales at COTA and, you know, at Silverstone and everything, and, you know, the Vegas stuff selling out. But it is very interesting. It's a weird world for auto right now.
It's about and balance.
It's really exciting. Like I bite my tongue before I make any grand sweeping statements, but it, aside from the news that came out from the giant Tesla debacle today, like cars and
who saw that coming?
Yeah. Literally everybody that doesn't own stock, and probably those that don't stock.
I'd say everyone who applies critical thinking, actually.
That's not a large portion of the population anymore, but you know, the enthusiast section of the automotive world at least is in a very good place, as is evident by things like the, you know, the Raptor R and the Bronco Raptor and, you know, the Ranger Raptor and what I'll say will probably make Mike squirm, but, you know, the prospect of all of us holding our breath for a Maverick ST, stuff like that is really exciting, and it really keeps us all engaged in spite of, you know, another round of Accord hybrids, which I'm sure Dan.
It is when you stop and think about it for a sec with all the different choices you have, it really is like a golden age for vehicles to pick what you want from a Porsche Dakar to an F-150 Raptor R to everything in between. I mean, that's a toy box.
I do want the friend who owns both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chris, I'm just waiting for you to buy them. Get after it, man. I mean, considering, you know, the car 911s are gone for as much as my house, so it's crazy. Mike, can we talk about S650 for a couple minutes?
Sure.
So as somebody who has driven probably 25 of the current outgoing Mustang, what can we expect from the 650? Because the literal only thing that I've ever complained about with the existing Mustang is the MT-82 has been a little problematic, and I wish it had a 911-esque optional large gas tank. That's it. So the 650 has a lot of promises. What can you tell us about it?
I mean, quickly, I would tell you, I've driven the Dark Horse. I think that with the fourth gen 5-liter Coyote, the twin throttle body intake for it, it gives the induction a whole new noise, and the exhaust, as we were talking about earlier, I just love the exhaust note of the 24 Mustang. I also like the fact that we're applying technology so that you'll have remote rev in your pocket, so that when you're sitting there drinking your coffee, you can always blip the throttle using the key fob to hear the sweet sound of your engine, even when you're not behind the wheel. I think the other thing that people are going to really take note of once they spend more time with the vehicle is the digital cockpit. Like I could just tell you that the first time I got into Mustang, obviously everyone loves to take Mustang, and I've owned several myself and love to drive them and engage with them and do all that. Usually it would have been in the past, okay, well, I'm going to start the vehicle up and I'm going to, you know, head to Angeles Crest. And, you know, I think the first time I got into a new Mustang, I spent probably about 20-25 minutes playing with the digital cockpit, just trying to wrap my head around all the different ways that you can now personalize the car to you digitally and then save that and just completely tailor the vehicle to what you want to do with it. You know, and that includes, by the way, not just the way it drives, but the fact I love that the designers got, you know, had some fun and are bringing back like the Fox body gauge cluster.
Yeah, it's a good look back. I mean, God, I remember the first time I sat in an 05, like an early 197 with the change the color of the gauges and the whole ambient lighting. Like, it was mind blowing. So yeah,
looking yeah, this just to takes it to the next level. I think the one thing that I have not tried yet that I'm most looking forward to is the electric drift brake. Like that to me, like, you know, you were talking earlier about having, you know, Vaughn getting Junior on, and the fact now that, you know, Vaughn played a role in the development of this electric drift brake, and man, I gotta try this, because it pretty much takes a novice and turns them into like a Vaughn getting junior.
Yeah, that goes one of two very distinct ways. So hopefully it has been programmed properly.
Track use only.
Track use only. Yep. The same way line lock is track use allegedly only. It's good. It's good. And the reimmersion of the color shift paint is appropriate. We've all probably seen on the internet at some point the tip of your finger change the color of your car kind of stuff that's, you know, on the prospect of future. So I don't know. I grew up with the, you know, color shifting Terminators, so it's good. It's very good. Dan and Mike, if you could make your dream vehicle out of all of the Ford products between engines, transmissions, chassis, suspensions, how would you make one, and bodies, all of the stuff?
But don't pigeonhole Dan into Ford only. Like, I want to hear Dan. I want to hear what Dan's ultimate vehicle is.
Well, for me, if I could do anything, it would look like a Wrangler. It would be powered by probably a Voodoo, and it would have a transmission out of a a GT3. So let's do Ford and let's do Grand World.
Who needs time to think?
Yes.
Well, the problem is there's so, you know, every time I think of a car, there's another one that comes up and, you know, oh, I should have said that. And I don't play these games very well.
You mean fantasy is difficult?
Okay, it's not a drinking game, so you're good.
I mean, you know, one of the things is, yeah, I am an, you know, off-roading is this thing I like to do in my spare time. And I've had a Jeep and I have a 4Runner. And I've always seen the Bronco as kind of like the average of those two. In other words, you get the removable roof and the open air experience and the doors that come off of the Jeep, but you get the independent front suspension and the nice road manners of the 4Runner. And that's, you know, like kind of like a great in between. Now, I keep wanting to get a hold of a Bronco that has Badlands with a 33 inch tires to do a flex test. And it seems like Sasquatch is on everything. So I've never gotten to actually try out the one I think would be the best.
Chris doesn't come. Well, he lives in Boston. Never mind. Scratch that.
No, but
he put on oversized tires too.
I like that truck a lot. I don't own one. You know, the paid off 4Runner has a lot of appeal because it's paid off, and so I can put money into shocks and a rooftop tent or solar panels or something like that because I don't have a car payment, you know. So so a paid off car is always a good thing, but it's not really playing your game. That's the problem.
Fair enough. I mean, we're all playing in theoreticals in my, you know, nonsensical little world here.
You know, I've had off-road pickups before, but I think the articulation I get out of the 4Runner with a shorter wheelbase and the ability to sleep inside and carry things that are protected from the elements is appealing. And then when I use all four seats, the rear seats are a little bit bigger than they are in the back of any of the compact trucks, you know, the Ranger, the Colorado, the Tacoma. The rear seats are just a little smaller than they are in the 4Runner, which has actually almost got leg crossing leg room back there.
We don't talk about the back seat of the Tacoma. That is not a conversation piece on the show anymore.
So I mean, but that's, I don't know. I'm kind of skating away from your question.
That's okay. That's okay. I'm just taking the cattle prod out with this one.
Yeah. But I mean, I like a lot of things about the Rivian, but I don't like quad motors. I'd rather have two. I'd rather have a mechanical diff lock. I'd rather that when I'm pushing on the throttle pedal that the motors are doing what I tell it to do rather than something that the algorithm is figuring out. And, you know, so, but I mean, the fact that that's electric, the fact that it's, I think the gear tunnel is brilliant. I think the cab size is kind of right sized, you know, it's more like a Ridgeline in terms of the interior and rear seat space. Yep. It's not full size, but it's certainly not the Tacoma.
It uses the space in a very,
yeah. And it's got the frunk and to Mike's point, the power to be able to go, you know, to power your campsite off-road. You know, I like the idea of the Lightning. I still haven't really spent any time with one. That's going to happen in the next week or two.
It's,
but it's not quite the off-road suspension, I think, you know, that, yeah. You know, I'd like to see like a Raptor version of that.
Oh yeah. Mm.
You know, with that kind of suspension, you know, and that kind of, travel.
So as we talked about before, I spent a week with a Lightning and I think my actual only complaint about it was that it had the big wheels and it rode a little bouncy, but the stipulation and caveats of this is that the roads in Connecticut where I live are, it turns out, terrible because it's cold here half of the year, and big wheels with small sidewall doesn't make for the best road quality.
Yeah.
Who knew? the Raptor suspension and wheel and tire package applied to a Lightning would be spectacular.
Right. But I mean, the way that transverse motor is sitting there, they just can't do that.
Right.
It would have to be right. A different thing than what a Lightning is. But to Mike's earlier point, this is early days. These are the first generation products in many cases. And as time goes on, stuff like this will get solved and figured out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like 1905 for cars, but
we're at the point where we're just trying to get people to buy electric pickup trucks. Where, you know, once we get past that point, then we can start specializing.
It is exciting. We should wrap up the show.
We should, but I want to hear Mike's dream mashup before we wrap.
You know what? I'm going to tell you that it's the one I've been waiting for the longest, I'm just going to say up front, I haven't taken it off road yet. But I'm very much looking forward to Ranger Raptor. It's a great size, to the point that Dan and I were talking about earlier, for a mid-sized truck trail, not a full size.
Yep.
To be able to, you know, take advantage of an improved suspension, which is what I would assume without me going into too much detail. So, to me, that's of all the vehicles that I see us having, it'd be Ranger Raptor. I think Bronco Raptor, having driven Bronco Raptor and knowing it's such a moon buggy, is also very, very impressive.
Yeah. As an extreme consumer of Australian 4x4 content, I have high expectations for the Ranger.
Yeah, the Baja 1000 of the Ranger Raptor was super impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. As Ford continues to do with the surprise Baja successes. So
the success isn't surprising. It's just that they ran the next generation truck and didn't really tell anybody, that kind of stuff.
Seriously. I saw the one that was a couple generations ago of Raptor, that was the new Raptor under the old Raptor body. And stand there and drool. So
yep.
On that note, we've done a show. This is we've really gone places on this.
I'll wrap it up real quick. You can rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Most of you still on Apple Podcasts. You can like and subscribe on YouTube. You can follow Dan on Instagram at Suspension Tuna. If you want to find his Twitter, it does exist. It's still tied to you. He's not on Twitter. It's still there. Yeah, it's still there. Mike is at Mr. Levine everywhere.
He did a good job. Pickuptrucks.com.
No, not pickuptrucks.com anymore.
That was the first I heard of Mike, so I had to throw that dip in there.
Well, thanks for having us on.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
And that's it. We did the show. Let me hit stop.
This is the show.